Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead, sir.
We thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. This will be our last call of the week, and at this time, I'd ask the Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct our roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd like to remind everybody that this event today is open to the press and for any members of the media on the call. If you have any questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I will call the roll. Commissioner Bowditch.
Here.
Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier.
Present.
Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
Present, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
Commissioner Lombardo will be joining momentarily.
Commissioner McDonald.
Present.
Commissioner Moody.
I'm here. Afternoon. Oh, great.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon. I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan?
Here.
And Commissioner Washington?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you, Dean. Any other announcements to make today?
No, sir. We're good to go.
Okay. Thank you. We have completed the hearings on crime reduction, and we're transitioning to the topic of reentry. All the commissioners should now have the bios and testimony of this panel, and as a reminder, we'll be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we cannot thank the commissioners and the working groups enough for your commitments and efforts for this historic commission. On behalf of General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and we'll then open the questions after the last witness. Commissioners know we spent the last 2 weeks on the topic of crime reduction, and yesterday we heard from victims. Today we'll transition to the topic of reentry and learn about best practices, successful programs, and where we as a nation and the components of the criminal justice system or systems can make and or facilitate improvements to our current environment. Our first distinguished panelist is Mr. Tony Loudon, who is the Executive Director of the Federal Interagency Council on Crime Prevention and Improving Reentry. He has a lengthy dedication and period of service to the issues involving reentry. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Loudon. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to all the commissioners, thank you for allowing me to be a part of this, I call historic event. And I've been blessed to be a part of some of your panels and listen in, and you guys are doing tremendous work, and I just want to be a part of it and also help implement the report once you guys finish the report. I'd like to start off by saying that the reentry process, I believe, begins the day of the individual is arrested and enters the criminal justice system. What we do from day one determines how we can successfully transition that individual back to society and successfully decrease their likelihood of returning to a criminal behavior and creating more victims. Some of the evidence best practices that I've seen in the state of Georgia and other places around the country are those evidence-based programs when we find a way to make sure that from day one they enter into our programs, we have a game plan to get them to change their behavior and their culture, as well as putting together a what I call a GPS plan, a transition accountability plan, where that individual, the moment they get ready to go home, they are prepared to go home. I believe in making improvements in the way we prepare former offenders to reenter society is critical. It's a critical element for an effective crime prevention strategy, not just from what we do as staff, from correctional officers to reentry officers, but what we do for the aftercare too, so that those individuals do not return back into our facilities. This year alone, over 42,000 inmates will be released from the federal prison system. Many will return to their communities with strained relationships from either their families, their loved ones, or victims of their crimes, and sparse job skills, making a sharply angled upward mobility for them to actually to compete within our society. Every day, the criminal justice officials make decisions that have enormous implications for public safety and spending. Since 2007, more than 30 states have passed significant reforms designed to prioritize prison beds for serious offenders, reduce incarceration, reduce recidivism rates, and contain costs. Red states like Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, Utah, and others have seen real results. Texas, for example, saved taxpayers over $2 billion while dropping its crime rate to its lowest levels since 1968. In Georgia and some of our metropolitan cities, we've seen the crime rate at its lowest ever because of some of the things that we've done proactively around our criminal justice reform systems. Standing up a reentry prison, turning a prison, a level 3 prison, into an evidence-based program facility where all 467 inmates now are on track to complete the program to change the culture and the behavior so that they can go out back out into society. Standing up charter schools with inside prisons so that young men and women can graduate with a high school diploma, and some of them for the first time ever hearing a graduation song marching down the aisle. Looking at ways of bringing the faith-based organizations inside our facilities so that they can start helping changing the behavior and the culture and help out with the family reunification. But more importantly, bringing in companies and employees who can hire these returning citizens the moment they get out. Now, I will say this here, and I know there's going to be a lot of experts today to talk about different types of frameworks and models, but I would like to talk about one that I saw out in Las Vegas. And it's called Hope for Prisoners Program, run by a gentleman by the name of John Ponders. This program is one of the most unique programs I've seen in my entire life, where they actually have the folks that arrested the individual for their crime is now mentoring them during the aftercare process. Changing the culture and the stigma of individuals that they've arrested, but more importantly, making Las Vegas safe. And that program, I had an opportunity to go down and monitor the program and look at the fact that now they have trust with the law enforcement agency and trust with what I now call the returning citizen. Some of the lessons that I've seen and we have learned throughout our challenges is that policymaking and legislations are much easier to accomplish than implementing. So often we know that we pass legislation to do reentry and prison reform, and that those buzzwords have been around forever, but it's the implementation piece which is the most important part. It requires that we take the opportunity to know that we have to have the guidance to do it, the time to do it, the organization and the competency to do it so that we can get the job done. Dedication to driving data-driven resources and approaches to make our strategies work. And then spend most of our time focusing on core areas that create sustainable system change. And I like to use that word and underline the word sustainable. Too many times we send out RPFs and grants and get people excited about prison reform, and then that program is not sustainable. And then 4 years later, after the grants are run out, or 2 years later after the grant is over, now we have a different model and something different that's not sustainable. And that best practice program that we champion is no longer existing. Engage local communities in planning and coordination, because they're very important for them to be a part of the aftercare, as well as bringing them inside our systems to work on reuniting them back to their community. And then lastly, my recommendations, and I will close with this. Utilize a program assessment inventory, similar to what they did in Cincinnati, similar to what they did in Georgia, similar to what we have on a federal level, the pattern, on existing programs to determine the strengths, areas of improvements, and gas. Establish risk needs, responsibility assessment for all offenders that is norm on the population. Utilize evidence-based practices, models, and some of our models are going to be different. But let's look at models that work and not something that sounds good or a good story. Family unification. Reentry plans established prior to release and share with stakeholders. And why do I say share with stakeholders? Because those stakeholders will help implement those reentry plans once the aftercare process takes place. Stakeholders in all direct and indirect services be educated in knowing who you're working with and what literature and motivational interviews we need to make sure that we bridge that gap so it's sustainable. I've seen a program that just piques my attention and my interest that's called Credible Messengers. The U.S. attorneys in Atlanta and several other states are using it, where former inmates who have made it and out doing great things are meeting men and women at the door once they've been released, walking them through their case plan, walking them through the process of going to work the very next day, walking them with the family unification place. It's one of the most incredible mentorship programs I've seen in a long time. Implement reentry counselors. And I know someone will say, well, we have reentry counselors. And that's good, but I do believe that we need to go a little bit deeper. Well, what I call reentry navigators, who can start working with them with their plans, walking them with their plans, because 90% of individuals that come into our system don't have the soft skills, or they adapt to the culture that's with inside our prisons. And reentry advocates, who can connect the community, the employers, all in one holistic approach to make sure that the system is running together. Assessment classifications, inmate programming, inmate release preparation, supervision and services, discharge and aftercare. I believe that those things are crucial when we talk about evidence-based principles guiding offenders' interactions at every decision point. And I mean every decision point once they get ready to come home. And thank you. I'll leave the rest of my time for questions.
Thank you, Director Loudon, for your informative testimony and certainly many years of dedicated service. Our next distinguished panelist is FBI Special Agent Jason Hardy out of the New Orleans office of the FBI and who is the author of The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Thank you for joining us today, Agent Hardy. You're recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Commissioners, for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to speak with you. My name is Jason Hardy. I'm an FBI agent stationed in New Orleans, but I'm here today to talk about my years working as a probation and parole officer, or PO, as we were known to our clients. There are currently about 4.5 million people on probation and parole in America, more than double the prison population. In simplest terms, probation and parole are the final outcome of most felony convictions in this country. As such, probation and parole should be at the heart of any honest discussion about reentry. Unfortunately, in many jurisdictions, probation and parole are afterthoughts. In 2012, when I began my career with probation and parole in Louisiana, the only tool we had at our disposal to keep people from going back to prison was the prison system itself. Our pitch to clients was simple: knock it off or go back to jail. Even as a rookie PO, I could see that the math didn't add up. Prison, though necessary in some cases, was also the most expensive solution to crime and the most intrusive. If we could reform a certain segment of the population in a way that was more equitable both to our clients and to taxpayers, why weren't we doing it? I'd like to speak to you today about 5 obstacles to effective reentry through probation and parole and offer a few common sense, cost-effective solutions. Obstacle number 1, high PO caseloads. If the PO is to help a client change his life, he has to get to know the client on a human level, his past struggles, his goals for the future, his sense of where he went wrong last time around. POs do this not only through conversation at the office, but also through home visits, visits on the job site, and check-ins over the phone. With a caseload of 220 clients, I was on a first-name basis with about 60. Half of my caseload I couldn't have picked out of a lineup. Caseloads in the 200 range were the norm across Louisiana. It came as no surprise that 43% of parolees in the state were back in prison within 5 years of their release. To help bring caseloads down to more manageable levels, the Commission could consider allocating federal funds to supplement PO staffing in high-poverty, high-crime areas. If fully funding positions is deemed cost-prohibitive, consider covering the cost of training. Police academies represent major upfront expenses, but often impede agencies' ability to hire. Obstacle number two, lack of addiction counseling and detox services. Substance use played a role in the struggles of more than 70% of my caseload. I told clients to be candid with me about their addictions, but they figured out pretty quickly that this was bad advice. If they told me they'd relapsed, I took them to jail. The city jail was the only detox facility that POs could access on short notice. Once detoxed, clients could usually be admitted to short-term inpatient facilities throughout the city, but the process was a total crapshoot. Our own agency had no established relationship with the given facility. POs were, in effect, dependent upon the charity of outside organizations, most of which were, in turn, relying on grant money and donations to stay afloat. It wasn't uncommon for me to send a client to a facility only to discover that the funding had run out and there was a padlock on the door. While underwriting inpatient treatment facilities may prove too costly, the Commission could consider providing federal funding for medical detox services to support the needs of local law enforcement in jurisdictions where city and county jails currently shoulder the majority of the detox burden. Obstacle number three, lack of housing resources. According to Volunteers of America, about 10% of inmates parole to the streets. In New Orleans, as in many cities, our homeless shelters were extremely dangerous and full of drugs. I knew of only one functional halfway house. I honestly can't remember a single homeless parolee who completed his supervision. Every one of them eventually went back to jail, either as a result of committing a new offense or because I came to believe that locking them up was the only way to save them from a fatal drug overdose. In one respect, housing is a straightforward issue. Parolees with housing have a better track record of getting work, staying clean, and maintaining interpersonal relationships. The main obstacle to addressing homelessness is the cost. One possible solution for the Commission to consider is a short-term rental voucher system that gives parolees at least 3 months to try to get on their feet. A more affordable alternative could be providing federal funding to support the development of a broader network of halfway houses so that no one paroles directly to the streets. Obstacle number four, lack of job training and employment opportunities. Many of my clients had at best an eighth grade education. No more than half had a high school diploma or GED. Everyone had a criminal record. Even entry-level employers often refuse to consider probationers and parolees. The only job opportunities that seemed to pan out involved employers who were going out of their way to hire people with criminal records. These employers were willing to work with our clients as they transitioned from prison life to the community. Sometimes this meant being patient with time management. Sometimes it meant playing an active role in training and retaining the individual. To POs, these employers were godsends. Gainful employment was the single most reliable predictor of rehabilitation. While funding job training and trade school programs has a lot of potential for higher functioning clients, I recommend that the Commission focus on incentivizing employers to recruit probationers and parolees from across the spectrum. One way to do this would be to consider new tax incentives to induce small business owners to train and hire people with criminal records. Obstacle number five, lack of mental health resources. Like untreated substance abuse, untreated mental health struggles are a recipe for future crime. No less than a quarter of our clients, and probably far more, struggle with their mental health. Public mental health care was available through the state, but clients needed a prior diagnosis to take advantage of this service. The only way to get clients a diagnosis was to provide them access to health care, but almost none of our clients received Medicaid benefits, even though nearly all of them met the income requirements. To ensure that probationers and parolees who qualify for public assistance receive it, the Commission could recommend mandating that all state-level felony inmates be screened for Medicaid before their release. This could be done by funding additional social workers within state prisons or by covering overtime pay for current staff. POs who can plug clients immediately into needed health care services, especially among clients suffering from substance use disorders and mental health struggles, have a far better chance of keeping clients from reoffending. The math that POs learn to do over time can feel cynical. Most of us trained ourselves to think in terms not of wins and losses, so much as harm reduced. We couldn't convince every drug dealer to get a day job. We couldn't help every addict get clean or every person struggling with his mental health to take his medication. But for every client we redirected from the life of crime and incarceration, the ripple effect was immeasurable. Clients who got well and got employment went from tax burdens to taxpayers. They became better parents, better neighbors, and better citizens. As crucial as reentry initiatives are in our prisons, they come with one important limitation. Prisons are controlled environments. Probation and parole take place in the real world. New skill sets, new coping mechanisms, and new ways of thinking have to hold up to the stressors of daily life. A PO with time to get to know all of his clients and resources to address his needs can help the client make adjustments as he goes and redirect him when he strays from the path. Prison reentry lays a crucial groundwork, but probation and parole are what bring the formerly incarcerated individual home. Thank you, Commissioners, for your time. I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Thank you, Agent Hardy, for your valued testimony and certainly for your service to our country. Our next distinguished panelist is John Kofis, who is the National Director of Reentry Initiative at the Right on Crime campaign. Mr. Kofis is also the Executive Director of Safe Streets and Second Chances. Mr. Kofis, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Vice Chairperson Sullivan and esteemed commissioners. It's a real honor to be testifying before you today. I have a little bit different pathway to reentry than the prior two esteemed panelists. I started my career in New Jersey and became a certified criminal trial attorney. I was a defense lawyer and a civil rights lawyer. However, I was a completely functional alcoholic. Many of the things that Special Agent Hardy were talking about in addiction treatment speaks to me directly. And in 2011, I crashed my car driving drunk and hurt someone and tried to lie my way out of it. And that ended my 20-year battle with addiction. Thank the Lord that person I hit, lived, and recovered. But I would go to prison in the New Jersey state system. And I'll tell you, when I went to prison, I want to start with this. You know, despite the fact I had owned a law firm, had all the trappings of success, nobody in prison asked me for money. But nearly everybody in prison asked me for a job. Virtually everybody I dealt with did not want to go back to prison and just simply did not know how. So I had no idea, candidly, at that point, what reentry was. Back then, it was a term that was floating around. And I had no idea I would work in it until I saw almost a Kafkaesque system where prisoners would leave the New Jersey Department of Corrections to go to halfway houses without identification or with old fines and fees. And then they'd be returned almost, you know, in a matter of weeks because they couldn't get a job or an old warrant popped up. And as a person who tried many, many murder cases in my life, I said, you know, this is something that is relatively simple. I don't know why anyone's not fixing it. I had the blessing of being granted parole. And New Jersey's parole system at that time is a model you should, I would encourage the commissioners to look at. Back then, it was led by Jim Plosis, was its chairman. He was the former U.S. Marshal in New Jersey under George W. Bush, and one of the most innovative parole chairs in this country, and a law enforcement leader. And New Jersey's parole system was one that did its best to connect people to employment, did a very good job at handling fines, fees, warrants, etc. The problem they faced was that they didn't get the person until at some point post-release. So I had a chance meeting in New Jersey with a former governor Jim McGreevy, who was doing ministry inside one of the jails. He took me to see Governor Christie at the time, and we ended up building something called the New Jersey Reentry Corporation. And what we did at the New Jersey Reentry Corporation is we focused on four broad areas in a hub-and-spoke model. And what I mean by that is we served as Pastor Loudon, Director Loudon talked about, the reentry navigator. We served that purpose. So people came from eight different counties. We had nine physical plants in eight counties. And the first thing that would occur when a person entered our facility was we would do an assessment that covered behavioral, addiction, physical health, do they have suitable housing, what workforce skills do they have, and that do they even have identification. The ones that we did that, we could assign people to fix those different things. Which brings me to my three broad recommendations I put in my written I listed in my written testimony, and those speak to, those are a problem. Excuse me, in every state I deal with, and I deal in about a dozen states. The Safe Streets and Second Chances Project that I have the privilege of leading is a research and foreign policy project that's operating in Florida, Texas, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, South Carolina, Ohio, and Indiana. I've also done a lot of work in Mississippi, Iowa, New Jersey, of course, and on the First Step Act. So the one commonality, and I think is a really nice place that the commission can focus on, are incentivizing prisons when DOJ money goes to prisoner reentry efforts, whether it's in the prison in a state, that every inmate needs to leave incarceration with a DMV, Department of Motor Vehicle, non-driver identification card, or a driver's license, not a prison ID. Even in states like New Jersey, the prison is still releasing almost all their inmates with a prison ID, which is valueless. It's worth about 1 point when you try to get a real identification, a real ID card. Now, I took the liberty of listing a table of services that and Special Agent Hardy addressed a lot of this in his testimony, of the types of services that are necessary for success in reentry. And if you refer to the table on page 2 and 3, you'll see just the basic eligibility requirements for every single one of these things is at minimum identification. So it's the lowest hanging fruit that no one's picking up. Florida has a really good system if you were born in the state of Florida. So Florida will get you a birth certificate and the identity documents you need if you were born in state. If you were born out of state, you're out of luck. So those are the sorts of things that need to change. Moving past ID, the next thing we can do, and this will, what I'm about to tell you is going to free up law enforcement resources, and of course promote success for the returning citizen, which is create a system to resolve fines, fees, and low-level charges before release. So as everyone in the prison knows, an inmate's on ready to leave, a detainer check is performed. If someone shows up with a detainer and the jurisdiction doesn't want to come get them, a new court date for a few months down the road is given, typically for some unpaid fine. Well, what happens then is this population, when they're released, still has no ability to resolve that, but they've been sitting in prison for X amount of years and could have resolved it while in prison. We dealt with this problem in New Jersey. I ended up having the privilege of building the largest driver's license restoration program in the country, 70 pro bono lawyers connected by a single cloud-based case management system, and we restored over 400 driver's licenses in the 3 years I was there, thousands of pieces of identity documents, and then people could get living wage jobs. Once someone has those basic identity documents and other supportive services that other folks have mentioned, one of the great untapped resources for businesses in this country is the WIOA, W-I-O-A, on-the-job training program. What OJT does is it reimburses an employer for up to 50% of a person's salary so long as they're working towards industry-recognized credentials. So if you have someone that you're going to train on the job, they might have an OSHA certification, they might have a ServSafe, they might have an electrical certification, the employer can recoup this money. This is administered by the U.S. Department of Labor, but two problems. Number one, the people that come into the American job centers to apply, the returning citizens, don't have the eligibility requirements because of things I mentioned before. And number two, the application process and the incentives need to be aligned. If you do that, that money exists, and if it would require very little additional money. In fact, most jurisdictions don't even spend all their OJT money that they're given pursuant to WIOA allocations each year. I think you'll see a great return on investment if you do those things. And I'll just close talking about a couple of other programs. I think, you know, I'm a big believer that good reentry can only work if it begins with a badge, which probably speaks, you know, volumes to the commissioners. I would encourage the commissioners to check out the federal reentry courts in the District of New Jersey. These are courts led by the U.S. Attorney's Office, by Craig Carpenito, and before that, Paul Fishman was a big proponent of them. There's reentry courts in Newark and Camden. Again, they're led by the U.S. Attorney's Office, where folks on supervised release after their prison sentence can work that number down. I would encourage folks also to look at what John Wetzel's doing in Pennsylvania, connecting PennDOT to his prison system, which helps to alleviate some of the identification issues. Heidi Washington in Michigan has her vocational village program, great job training program. And Brian Sterling in the South Carolina Department of Corrections has three separate reentry prisons where offices of motor vehicles, offices of labor, human services, they all hold standing offices in these reentry prisons to provide greater connectivity to service, to different services. I want to thank you all for your time, and I look forward to the question and answer session. And one last thing I'll close with is effective reentry is one of the best crime prevention strategies law enforcement can get involved in. It's like a hospital targeting the sickest population. As law enforcement officers, you already know that the people coming out of the prison system are the most likely to commit crimes and go back. If we target them effectively, we'll be able to make safer and more prosperous communities, free up precious law enforcement resources to fight crime for those people still committing crimes. And as Pastor Loudon said, we'll see a great return on family reunification. And with that, I yield and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kofas, for your testimony today and for your valuable contributions to the criminal justice system. Our last panelist today is Dr. Grant Dewey. He is a criminologist and research director at the Minnesota Department of Corrections, as well as a scholar at Baylor University's Institute for Studies on Religion. He has published over 50 research studies and program evaluations. Dr. Dewey, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm Grant Dewey, research director with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and it is a privilege and an honor to be able to provide testimony today on the topic of reentry. And given my background, I've been with the Minnesota DOC for over the last 15 years. I'll be focusing on prisoner reentry. When we attempt to determine the effectiveness of prisoner reentry initiatives, we often look at post-release outcomes like recidivism or employment. But when we see five-year rearrest rates that are near 80% and ex-prisoner unemployment rates that are much higher than what we see for the rest of the U.S. population, many have concluded that we don't do prisoner reentry very well. In fact, looking at the same evidence, the conclusion that's been drawn is that our state and federal prison systems are broken. And when we talk about prisoner reentry, that sometimes there's a tendency to focus on that which occurs either right before or right after release from prison. It's often said, and it was even mentioned earlier in the same context, that reentry begins the day that either someone's the day after someone's arrested, or in the context of prisoner reentry, the day after someone enters prison. So if we're really serious about improving reentry outcomes, then I think we need to take a broader look at our prison systems in general, or to put a finer point on it, I think we need to rethink how we do corrections in this country. And so for the rest of my testimony, I'm going to offer four key recommendations that, at least in my view, would produce leaner, more cost-effective prisons that are more successful in providing positive reentry outcomes. My first recommendation involves the elimination of warehousing. What I mean by that is when someone comes into prison, they don't participate in any meaningful programming, and then they get released. Recent research has shown that about one-third of those in Minnesota's prison system are warehoused, and we see it about half of those in the federal prison system do not participate in any evidence-based programming. When prisoners get warehoused, we see significantly worse outcomes for prison misconduct, post-release employment, and recidivism. There's been quite a bit of research that's been done over the last three, four decades that has shown there are effective interventions that reduce recidivism by targeting known risk factors for reoffending. Examples include substance abuse treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, sex offender treatment, and some education and employment programs. This body of research, which is known as the What Works literature, has really focused on determining whether individual programs or types of interventions are effective. And that's important. It's critical for us to know which programs or interventions work and are effective in reducing recidivism, but this same body of research hasn't shed much light on whether enough prisoners receive effective interventions or whether those who do receive interventions have been given enough of a dosage. We see that CBT, for example, is an effective intervention, but what if only 1 or 2% of a state's prison population is getting access to this intervention? And that's not all that uncommon, by the way, but would we expect 1 to 2% who participate in an intervention, would that have an impact on the overall recidivism rate? Probably not. But what if that intervention was administered to, say, 20% of the population or 30%? Would we start to see changes in the overall recidivism rate? Perhaps. But one of the things that we've learned from the What Works literature is that programming delivered to people who are lower risk, that sometimes it can make outcomes worse. I would argue, though, that too often we use this as an excuse to do nothing. Prisons don't have to be criminogenic finishing schools for crime, which is sometimes what they're made out to be, but this is what they are, however, when we warehouse people in prison. We should be focusing more on dosage and more specifically the extent to which inmates are participating in programming. And I would argue that we're under-programming or under-treating those in prison, and the lack of programming resources has been due, at least in part, to our overuse of prison. But it's also due to how prisons have been designed. A lot of correctional facilities in this country were built years ago. They weren't necessarily built with the idea, how can we make this prison a more program-rich environment that optimizes the delivery of effective programming? Instead, prisons have been designed and constructed for isolation, security, and control. My second recommendation is that we can deliver more programming that's proven to be effective without increasing the costs through prison downsizing. Over the last decade or so, we have seen the nation's imprisonment rate has decreased, and I would argue over the last 4 to 5 weeks, it's dropped even more. Because we've overused prison, I would also argue that this decline is a step in the right direction. Further reducing the use of prison is necessary to not only lower the cost, but also to free up the physical space that's needed within prisons to provide more programming, because that's one of the things that sometimes if for those who are unfamiliar with the prison environment, that there's often a lack of physical space to provide programming, and especially if prisons are filled to capacity, then that means that there's even less space to do that. We can reduce the size of prison populations without significantly compromising public safety by restricting probation and parole violator admissions, which make up about two-thirds of all prison admissions, by restricting those to the riskiest, most serious violators. And when they enter prison, when people do enter prison, it should be long enough to participate in effective programming, which usually lasts between 3 and 9 months. So revoking someone to prison and keeping them there for 45 days or 60 days, and they're being warehoused, they're not participating in any programming, that doesn't make any sense from a public policy perspective, and I would argue it's ineffective and wasteful. We can also effectively downsize by shortening the length of stay for those with longer sentences who have completed effective programming in prison. Reducing the number of prison admissions and shortening confinement periods for more inmates with longer sentences would generate decarceration savings or it would reduce our costs. But prison downsizing alone is not going to improve public safety unless it's accompanied by an increase in effective programming resources, not just for prisoners, but also for those in the community who are on probation and parole. And so my third recommendation would involve reallocating decarceration savings to provide more programming resources for those in prison and also for those lower risk probation and parole violators who would remain in the community. In addition to these three strategies, I believe we also need to do a better job of leveraging technological advancements that may provide more cost-effective ways to ramp up the delivery of programming, and that's my fourth recommendation. While some correctional systems have begun to offer video visitation or started using tablets to provide programming, there's a lot more that I think we can and should do to harness this technology to improve the prison experience, not only for inmates, but also for staff, too, because they have to work in these environments, and when people are engaged in programming, it makes prison a much safer environment. Implementing evidence-based reforms such as these would require a shift from punishment to a rehabilitation in both our ideology and practice. One enduring school of thought has been that if we make prison so horrible, it's going to motivate people to desist from crime. But increasing the misery of the prison experience, it may satisfy the impulse for retribution, but it doesn't lead to an effective use of taxpayer dollars. The evidence has long shown that punitive strategies alone are costly and ultimately ineffective in promoting desistance from crime. Instead, I would argue that we can achieve better reentry outcomes by eliminating warehousing and transforming prisons into more program-rich environments. Thank you for the invitation to be with you here today.
Thank you, Dr. Dewey, for your most informed testimony and for providing this commission with your recommendations. Commissioners, we are now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with a question, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist. Or if you have a question for the entire panel, please state so. Just as a reminder, commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, and now we entertain questions from commissioners. Questions from commissioners.
I feel this is Don Washington. I have a question in general for the panel.
Yes, Commissioner, you're recognized. Thank you.
Okay, for the panel, this is sort of a broad question. I recognize that, but do you have any specific thoughts on this whole concept of collateral consequences and as it impacts recidivism? Yeah, I understand that collateral consequences comes with a whole bunch of stuff. For example, one of the presenters talked about issuing particular identification cards and stuff like that to kind of help the path of reentry. But there are some judges around the country who are particularly sensitive now to this whole idea of collateral consequences as being one of the big contributors to recidivism. And my question is there anything for us to, as a commission to know about with respect to specific items that we could address as a to reduce this concept of collateral consequences as a contributor to recidivism?
This is John Kufos. If it's okay, Commissioner, I'll start us off. Is that okay?
Yes, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. So collateral consequences, as you point out, Commissioner, are a tremendous problem in the criminal justice system. The Council of State Governments Justice Center released a report, I think late last year, where they talked about 40,000 of them. And these are things that range from ability to vote all the way up to occupational licensing. And I think that's a great place, especially for our attorneys general who's serving as commissioners and in our and in your extended networks. In many states, the licensing boards are under the attorney general's office. And occupational licensing, where they have restrictions on felonies, often kills the ability of someone to get a job. And what happens is the state ends up wasting money when you do train someone for a job that they ultimately can never get. And we've seen cases around the country, everybody from barbers and hair braiders to certain types of building trade folks simply can't get an occupational licensing. So I think, in my opinion, is if this commission, we're gonna focus on something that there's a lot of bipartisan support for, and that just makes really smart economic sense and public safety sense. Review of the occupational licensing structure in individual states would be the way to go.
Thank you. Other panelists with responses to Commissioner Washington's question. Do any of the other panelists have responses for Commissioner Washington's question?
Yes, this is Tony Loudon. I agree with John because one of the things that we did in Georgia, we firstly banned the box so that when inmates get out of our prisons, they can go and get a job. Too often we have in our rural communities where we have prisons and jails, they're cutting the grass and they're helping cities balance their budgets. They're doing all the labor in those areas, and when they get out and go back to those same areas, because of the collateral consequences, they can't even apply for a job there. And so we also took the next step, and we banned the box on occupational licenses as well in the state of Georgia, so that inmates who can get out, they learn a trade while they're on the inside, they get certified. They can actually get an opportunity to be able to get their license and feed their families and make it happen for them and be a taxpayer in our society. I'll give you one that's been on my desk. I'm getting phone calls like crazy. We have individuals who've been out of prison for a year right now, and they have a job. They're doing good. And the stimulus money that comes out, because they have not filed taxes in a year, they do not qualify. And some of those individuals needed that $1,200 just to keep their business running. Some have started lawn services. Some have started other businesses in our communities, as well as open up barbershops and salons. And so they don't qualify. And so we have an economy that's falling apart, and these men can't even qualify for a stimulus. And we all know that crime and poverty become sisters when we have an opportunity to not help people get an opportunity to feed their families and take care of themselves. I strongly believe that when we talk about occupational licenses, that's a great place for this commission to start and be able to come up with some recommendation that could be a model for our country. Thank you.
Thank you. Other panelists with responses to Commissioner Washington's question.
This is Grant Dewey. I really don't have anything to add to what the two panelists have already mentioned. I think they covered the response pretty well.
Thank you. Commissioners with other questions?
Hi, this is Katie.
You recognize, Vice Chair?
Thank you. Hi, everyone. And I guess anyone could answer this. I was a judge like two other members on the commission, Erica McDonald and Ashley Moody. And one of the things that has struck me with some of the criminal justice reform and reentry programming is a disconnect between the programming in the jail and what might be available through judicially led reentry type of programs. So, for instance, as a judge, you would think about making a sentence for someone, perhaps a shorter jail sentence, with the idea that they go into drug court after. How, if you guys can think of, if there is a recommendation, or how do we bridge that gap? Or have you seen good examples of places that have bridged the gap? In my tiny little, you know, rural community, I talk to my captain in my jail all the time, so we were able to create that relationship. But in more urban communities, that isn't the case. So criminal justice reform sometimes feels like it's all or nothing, like we're going to just let everyone out of jail, when I have always thought that there's a pretty good midline, which is programming's in jail, case management for when people get out, and then continued support through the criminal justice system to ensure public safety and continued rehabilitation. So I'm just wondering if you guys have seen successful models of that or if you have any thoughts.
Well, Katie, I think, this is Tony Loud, I think you hit the nail right on the head. When we talk about being able to predict or to look at ways of how do we offer programs, I strongly believe that we cannot be afraid of the assessment tools that we use. A lot of people, there's a lot of pros and cons on assessment tools, and some assessment tools, they talk about the disparity in certain tools. But when we find assessment tools that work, I think we should allow those assessment tools to be used with the judge when they're sentencing so we can look at programs or recommendations from those assessment tools. Because now we're having this opportunity where we're filling up our prisons and our jails with those who are mentally ill when actually they need to go to a mental health court. Or those who are dealing with drugs addictions, they should be going to some type of drug program, whether it's in a jail or a prison or some type of aftercare. I think we have to get to that point of using the tools that we have, work out the kinks that we have, and then use those tools not just on the inside but on the outside as well, that sentencing as well, so that we can look at ways of being able to say, you know what, here's some programs that can work and we have some evidence that it's working. We want to put this a part of the sentencing package as well. And I also believe that those same assessment tools can help with probation and parole as well. Thank you.
And this is John Kupos. I agree with Tony Loudon. Two other things I'd mention. For a broad-based model, some states, including New Jersey, have passed mandatory drug court laws for certain offenses. That means if you present with an addiction and you have a certain background and your offense is in a disqualifying offense, it's required that you go to drug court or go to prison. So that's one thing. I can tell you, when I was in prison and I have, obviously I went to law school and college, I took electrical trades when I was in prison. I was there for 17 months before I was paroled. And I have many electrical trade certificates, but I never touched a wire in all that time. So the quality of training, if I were trying to become a person working in the electrical trades, getting that in New Jersey Department of Corrections would not have benefited anyone. One of the things that I think, although it's a post-sentencing model, are those federal reentry courts I mentioned earlier. The judges there do a really good job of connecting community service providers to the population. And I think the other places you're seeing it, and I'm glad that this commission has addressed, mental health issues and CIT, crisis intervention teams, those have spawned really innovative diversion programs. So in some places, I think it's called the Blue Heart Program in New Jersey, and they have them in other states as well, where officers can bring someone to rehab instead of jail, depending on the offense and the offender's history. And then from there, the judge has the opportunity to make a decision because, Judge or Commissioner, the person who presents in sobriety or in recovery at sentencing looks a lot different than the person who presents still in their active addiction.
This is Jason Hardy. If I could weigh in as well, one of the things I wanted to speak about today, and I just didn't have the time, I'm a huge believer in this drug court model, and I can tell you that for probation and parole officers, this is where we see the biggest success stories. And I think part of the reason that this model works so well is that there's a really clearly defined division of labor, where instead of the PO trying to be, you know, the counselor and the personal police officer and the job finder and the social worker, I mean, those are all jobs that are complicated and that require a lot of training and long apprenticeship periods to do well. And so in jurisdictions where POs are trying to do all this by themselves, they're just not going to get great results. But in a drug court environment, or in New Orleans, we also had mental health courts, we had veterans courts, you had basically a team of people assigned to each individual. So, you know, a person came in presenting whatever the issue was, whether it was mental health or substance use disorders, and, you know, the PO's job was to be out in the field seeing the person in the environment. And then he would report what he saw to the judge, and the judge could determine if some kind of enforcement action was needed. And if it wasn't, then there was a team of social workers there to connect that person with services. There were counselors on staff if the person needed some kind of counseling. We even had access to psychiatrists. So even in poor jurisdictions, we were seeing a will to do this kind of treatment. And really the results that we saw were just astounding. I mean, we saw people who had been on probation 3 or 4 times before and just, you know, were locked back up within a couple months. And when they're in this system where they're really being treated kind of as a valued commodity, and they see 6 or 7 professionals who are assigned to their care and really invested in seeing them succeed, it's just a whole different world.
If I could just add briefly, I think all of the panelists is right on when we talk about this, but if we had courts, hypothetically, if we had courts who all had what I call court specialists or chief community supervising officers, and some do around the country, but if we offered incentives to them to help judges make decisions around resources and programs and new initiatives, I believe that can lower our incarceration rate around the country tremendously, because now the judges who are, we're trying to give more discretion, will have discretion to take a person who is on drug or a veteran who just came home and found himself homeless and now before a judge, or a person who's mentally ill and find himself before the judge. That community supervision specialist who have incentive from the very top of our agencies, law enforcement agency, can recommend programs for these individuals, and we will not have all of them coming inside our prisons as well.
Thank you. Vice Chair Sullivan, did that answer your questions?
It certainly did. Thank you.
Thank you. Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions for our panelists? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panels once again for your time and your most valuable testimony and the responses to the questions from commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Vita and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the Commission in their deliberations and work. Before we close, please note that tomorrow we'll be sending out the full schedule for next week as we wrap up a summary email for this week's activities. We'll also have 2 more reentry panels next week, Tuesday and Wednesday. And on Thursday, we'll have a panel to discuss grant supporting law enforcement and justice initiatives. We will continue this cadence for the next several weeks, and we also will be exploring having an in-person meeting in June if the operating environment changes around the COVID-19 virus. As always, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website, and we will update it regularly when we receive information. Any questions or comments from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your dedication and commitment. I hope everyone has a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, bye. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.